ir a participar. Yo creo que ese es el objetivo central, que participe. ¿Por qué? Porque la puerta a las mujeres, y especialmente a las mujeres indígenas, ha estado cerrada. Entonces, lo que estamos pidiendo, como diría el poeta Carlos Pellicer en un poema, es que se abra esa puerta.
Seguirán meses con mucho por hacer: desmoronar racismo y clasismo, recabar cientos de miles de firmas. Pero sobre todo a este movimiento le importa ahora recorrer el país completo, a hablar y escuchar, verse reflejados en los demás. Paula Mónaco, Felipe, Telesur, Chiapas, México.
La Organización de Naciones Unidas denuncia un marcado crecimiento en el número de ataques contra defensores de derechos humanos en América Latina. Beatriz Barral viene con los detalles.
En 2016, 3 de cada 4 asesinatos de defensores de los derechos humanos en el mundo ocurrieron en las Américas. El 41% de los asesinados se oponían a proyectos para extraer recursos naturales o defendían el derecho a la tierra y a esos recursos de los pueblos indígenas. Las personas defensoras de los derechos humanos son esenciales para el funcionamiento saludable de las sociedades y, sin embargo, los últimos años en las Américas han sido cada vez más atacados, dijo el alto comisionado de las Naciones Unidas para los Derechos Humanos en la presentación del plan conjunto con la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. Estas personas son víctimas de amenazas, campañas de difamación, detenciones arbitrarias, malos tratos e incluso tortura. Muchas de ellas corren el riesgo de ser víctimas de ataques violentos, a veces mortales, incluso, según el alto comisionado, por parte de particulares vinculados a intereses empresariales o a poderosas bandas criminales. Mientras los responsables de los asesinatos quedan impunes, hay una tendencia preocupante del uso de la ley para criminalizar las actividades de estas personas, para silenciarlas o castigarlas, asegura la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. Esta comisión y la ONU van a estudiar las medidas que los países de la región han implementado para proteger a los defensores y van a elaborar un manual de buenas prácticas para contribuir a su protección. Beatriz Barral, Naciones Unidas, Nueva York.
En México, una defensora de los derechos humanos denunció haber sido torturada y violada por policías en el estado de Guerrero. Desde la derecha se ha desatado una fuerte campaña en su contra. Norma Martínez reporta.
La defensora de los derechos de la mujer, Indira Sandoval, demandó justicia por las torturas y violación sexual que sufrió el pasado 16 de septiembre en el estado de Guerrero y denunció una campaña en su contra. Sandoval visitó el municipio de Tlapa de Comonfort para dar un taller sobre violencia de género cuando se hizo una cortada bajo una axila y acudió a una clínica. Después de la revisión, asegura, acudió a un cajero para extraer dinero, pero fue detenida por policías municipales quienes la acusaron de negarse a pagar por el servicio. Indira terminó siendo llevada a la cárcel, pero en el trayecto, asegura, fue golpeada por una mujer policía que al llegar a la celda la sometió por la fuerza y la violó con los dedos por unos 5 minutos.
Me duele porque es un tema personal, lo personal es político, que mi agresora tenga cuerpo y cara de mujer. Sin embargo, tengo que decir que yo no denuncié a una mujer o a una persona por su condición de género, de sexo, por su condición social, por su condición económica, por su condición de etnia, de ninguna manera.
En conferencia de prensa el miércoles, la antropóloga social dijo que decidió hacer público su caso porque ha recibido amenazas e intimidaciones.
Como el allanamiento a mi casa, a mi auto que se encontraba al interior del edificio donde actualmente vivo, desde llamadas a números telefónicos privados que habilité después de las agresiones que vivía en Guerrero.
Después de la violación y los maltratos, le dijeron que podía irse, pero la defensora de derechos humanos, conocedora de los protocolos, intentó denunciar los hechos. La Fiscalía Especializada de Delitos Sexuales de la Montaña estaba cerrada y un agente del Ministerio Público no la recibió y tuvo que regresar al día siguiente. Fue hasta dos días después de la agresión que pudo ser examinada por una psicóloga y un médico. Este último consignó que tenía laceraciones y lesiones en la vagina, así como heridas en brazos, antebrazos, pantorrillas y otras partes del cuerpo.
Ser defensora de derechos humanos es también lo que me permitió estar aquí narrando mi testimonio. Porque conocer los derechos, denunciarlos, defenderme, no permitir que nadie me intimidara, no quedarme callada aun cuando me habían cerrado el Ministerio Público en mi cara, aun cuando la Policía Municipal volvió a hacer presencia cuando intenté denunciar, aun cuando me practicaron un examen legista dos días después de la violación, aun cuando la psicóloga me preguntó que qué sentía estar en Tlapa, habiendo ido a dar una plática de género y haber sido violada en este municipio. Aun cuando el toxicológico me dijo que sabía lo que me atenía y todo lo que podía representar en mi contra, el hecho de que hubiera sustancias que yo no hubiera declarado. Como ya lo dije en un momento, beber no es un delito. Que me violen, que me torturen, que me criminalicen, que me hayan privado de mi libertad ilegalmente, que me revictimicen y que violen el debido proceso todas las instituciones, sí lo es.
La defensora de derechos humanos dijo que videos filtrados por la Fiscalía de Guerrero, donde aparece ebria discutiendo con policías, son parte de una campaña para deslegitimar su denuncia.
Que lo que ustedes vieron en esos videos, si bien son actos de prepotencia de los cuales no justifico y de ninguna manera me enorgullecen, lo que ustedes no vieron es cuando yo tuve que decir e incluso aseverar que no me iban a desaparecer después de las varias veces de haber preguntado por qué me detenían, cuál era el nombre de los oficiales, de qué se me acusaba, y que fui yo misma quien le solicitó a todos los elementos de sexo masculino que si bien me iban a detener y se negaban a explicarme por qué, fui yo misma la que solicitó que se apersonara en el momento y en la zona de los hechos una oficial de sexo femenino, porque conozco los protocolos de seguridad pública.
Asimismo, Sandoval niega haber insultado a la policía que la agredió diciéndole que era indígena y pobre, como aseguró la municipal en un video publicado en redes sociales.
Yo no denuncié a ninguna persona por su condición de género, de sexo, por su condición económica, por su condición de etnia. A ninguna de las personas las denuncié porque esos no son mis parámetros. Como defensora de los derechos humanos de las mujeres, pero también como feminista, porque son ojos distintos con las que uno ve el mundo, lamento la condición social que ella, la persona a la que a través de los videos con que se me criminaliza, yo identifico y señalo como mi principal agresora, lamento que esa vida y la mayoría de las mujeres en este país guarden esa condición social. Ser sobreviviente también me compromete para seguir luchando por un marco jurídico de derechos humanos en favor de las mujeres.
Indira Sandoval señaló que su acusación está dirigida al sistema, no a la mujer que la agredió.
Por todo lo anterior que he dicho, a mí me violó el Estado. El eslabón más débil de esta cadena de revictimización y de violencia y de criminalización, desafortunadamente, tiene rostro de mujer. Pero el eslabón más fuerte, que es el que voy a defender hasta el final, que es mi dicho, mi dignidad y mis derechos humanos, también lo tiene. Quiero enfatizar en decir que el caso de Indira Sandoval es un reto a la institucionalidad del Estado mexicano. Los últimos tres meses, con mucho dolor, pareciera que se ha hecho moda o modus operandi que las mujeres que decidamos beber sea motivo suficiente para que nos violen o para que nos maten, como el caso de Mara Fernanda o de Lucy. En mi caso lo estoy contando.
La antropóloga social presentó su denuncia ante la Procuraduría General de la República, la Comisión Nacional de Derechos Humanos y otros organismos federales y no descartó llevar sus exigencias de justicia hasta la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. Para el Informativo Pacífica, reportó Norma Martínez.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV, de Venezolana de Televisión y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Doshtri y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Hey, this is Uncle Dennis here. I want to ask you to support the Anarchist Library. The Sub Rosa hosts Santa Cruz's long-running Anarchist Library, around since the early 1990s, containing thousands of volumes on a variety of subjects, including ecology, history, philosophy, literature, politics, indigenous studies, feminism, psychology, and a small collection of zines. But did you know there are several ways you can support the Anarchist Library? Here are five ways you can help. Submit your review. Sub Rosa is interested in reviews of radical books, zines, and music. If you found something at Sub Rosa that you really liked or didn't, we encourage you to submit a review. You could buy books. There's a list of books we have in the library that they'd like to have, a wish list at a major online bookseller. You could donate books. You're an awesome radical, and you have some awesome books, so many, in fact, that you're ready to donate some of your library to the Anarchist Library. Just drop them off at Sub Rosa. You can donate cash. The Anarchist Library is hosted at Sub Rosa, and so by donating to the space, you are supporting the project. Alternatively, you can donate directly to the library, which occasionally buys new books for the collection. And lastly, check out the books and read them. We love to see the books in circulation, so check out Books at Sub Rosa for 2 weeks or more. This brought to you by the Anarchist Librarians at the Sub Rosa Cafe.
And coming up next on Free Radio at 101.3 FM and freakradio.org, it's the Thursday, October 26, 2017 edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Hopefully special interviews with Keith McHenry, Brent Adams, Steve Plaich, our locals, as well as real voices from the street, from the Food Not Bombs meal and thereabouts, and then an hour-long rebroadcast of the KPFA Flashpoints homeless show that featured the unusual temporary victory of the camp known as First They Came for the Homeless in Berkeley, with activists Osha Newman, Keith McHenry, Mike Zent and others on Dennis Bernstein's show. So all that coming up on Free Radio next, so don't go away.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So, first off on this show, I was able to get a hold of the most accessible of all the people I've been trying to reach today. That's Katzenjammer Keith McHenry. Hello, Keith.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always fun, sometimes repetitious, but sometimes, actually, usually quite informative. We're coming up on this show, as I mentioned to you before, we have you at length talking with a panel of people in Berkeley about what you talked about yesterday, or actually day before yesterday. So if you have new stuff you want to add, that would be helpful. Do you want to begin talking about anything you knew you've learned about new citations, of which I've heard there have been none yet, nobody's called me, around sleeping, camping, or let's say being in a park after dark from a homeless person trying to sleep in a tent or sleep outside?
No, I don't have any new news on that. It seems like basically the chief is not hassling people if they go to San Lorenzo Park. And but they definitely are moving everybody along in downtown. And so that, you know, is somewhat is, you know, it's an interesting thing because it seems like to me that part of the idea of is got an opinion piece. He's going to make sure nobody's living downtown, sleeping out downtown. You know, and therefore now he's a big hero amongst the people who are trying to drive the people away from downtown. So the issue is, though, when we spoke to him about, you know, what happens when it floods and everything, he just said he hoped it doesn't rain. So that was his solution for
it. Well, the weather report is dry for the next week, so I suppose that's good. You know, for me, it's I have to be cautious because people keep saying to me, those just sort of in the course of the days, conversations with folks, well, isn't this great? Isn't Chief Mills doing a good job? Isn't this a change for what you wanted? I mean, I was on KZSC last night, and I was asked this by John Sandich. You know, he wondered, you know, what do you think? Isn't this a great? Actually, I think a person who called in was saying people are being allowed not simply to camp in San Lorenzo Park during the night, but also to be there during the day and keep their tents up, which is what we, well, homeless people demanded in 1995 at the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, what happened at the Occupy movement in San Lorenzo Park in 2011. So should this be considered a positive sign, or is this more treachery in the making? What do you think?
Oh, I get the sense that it's treachery in the making. And what I think will potentially happen is that some once the shelter opens winter shelter, then they'll be like, okay, now you can all go in the winter shelter and you don't need to be here anymore, and isn't that great, and so on. So that's what I believe will be the situation that happens. And yet, you know, the winter shelter, there's some aspects of that are good. Part of the problem is that you have to, you know, basically your day ends at, you know, at 4 o'clock, because you have to catch the transportation to it. And so that is where there is kind of a problem. And
well, also, there's a shelter. There's a shelter limitation on the number of people, right?
Correct. There's that. There's also people who are easily 86 from there. Yeah, there's a lot of problems with that. So I am not so optimistic as most people are about this situation, and yeah, I don't really see that it's like, oh well, the Freedom Sleepers won the camping ban, you know, and thing, and you know what people actually kind of assume is what's happened, you know.
Do you have any sense of the numbers of people in San Lorenzo Park?
I have no idea, really. But, you know, most of the people that we, you know, that were sleeping downtown seem to have moved there. But I don't really know the numbers.
I mean, I walked over the bridge last night, the pedestrian walk bridge, and I saw, yeah, it was pretty early. It was around 9 o'clock. I would say maybe 15 or 20 tents and a number of sleeping bags. And, you know, maybe you could guess two or three people in a tent if you wanted to just wildly speculate. We're talking, that's a tiny fraction of the people who are homeless in Santa Cruz, but you say you haven't gotten any reports, although you only get about 100 or 200 people who come to the Food Not Bombs meals on the weekend, right?
Yeah, that's basically what's happened.
We only can kind of comment on a fraction of the homeless community, what's going on with them throughout Santa Cruz. Are they getting ticketed? Are they getting hassled? It is true that Andy Mills reported the Sentinel stated to, I think, his fifth gathering. He's been having community gatherings of people. You and I tried to get to one of those, and we went at the wrong time. But the most recent one, which was a couple of days ago, or maybe even yesterday, was reported in the Sentinel as having him say that his concern is dealing with, and I don't want to misquote what either the Sentinel said, although I have no idea if it's accurate about him, but it's something around moving along people in RVs in Santa Cruz.
Oh, we haven't heard that, but I'm not surprised that's a likely thing. Now, from the people that we know in Eureka who frantically started corresponding with us when it was announced that you would come here, that Mills would run like a very relatively sophisticated way of of dealing with homeless issues, and one is to give the impression that he's got these solutions and that people are receiving housing and everything's good, and then but at the same time it's actually not really what's going on. So this is what we have heard there, and this seems to be the case here, where I think that he's indicated strongly, for example, that it's likely that something will be done to try to remove the Food Not Bombs meal from downtown as part of a campaign to make sure people don't return there, and to give the impression that he has been solving all these problems and that it's, he's housed all these homeless people. He, gave out, for example, some hotel vouchers to a few people right before people were told to leave the post office area. And so it gives this nice, warm, kumbaya feeling that he's helping out. And then also it's interesting, there seem to, a lot of people are buying the thing that, oh, now it's the time for us to all embrace this new chief and that he's great and that, if you are not complimentary of him, you're somehow, you're not seeing what he's doing to help everybody and that he's compassionate and all that, then you're just getting in the way. So his strategy so far is kind of working. But I think that once things move along, if there is a really strong effort to do what he's implied surrounding the Food Not Bombs meal, then you'll find that things are a tad different. And so we just don't know. It's interesting.
Regarding the Food Not Bombs meal.
Back and forth about that.
Regarding the Food Not Bombs meal, Keith, I know at one point you and others were trying to mobilize people both to support stopping the movement of people away from the post office to nowhere at that time, or apparently now it is somewhere, San Lorenzo Park. But you were also concerned about potential attacks on Food Not Bombs in the sense of a city moving against it, requiring permits, yada, 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 using the hepatitis A scare as a basis for saying, oh, they have to be moved along, they're, the ground zero and all that crap. Have you been able to get together the emergency phone response list that would enable you to actually respond the way, let's say, first they came for the homeless supporters in Berkeley, successfully responded to the BART police arrival at the first they came for the homeless encampment on Tuesday and stopped them, along with, of course, the legal folks who showed up and volunteered to help, and actually initially a homeless man from the camp, I understand, trained by attorney David Beauvais, filed a lawsuit, and then Dan Siegel, previously a very militant activist, since then a very successful lawyer. One somehow transmogrifies into the other, but still he took on the case. In other words, I'm wondering, are you doing any kind of proactive potential response to an attack on Food Not Bombs?
Yeah, I mean, we do have. So the basic, we're at the level right now of trying to educate people as to what might be the position, what might be going on, some of the things that are happening. This is, like, not clear what's potentially going on. So, anyway, I've been just published a few minutes ago a blog on foodnotbombs.net about the general nationwide campaign using the buzzwords that, that we've been hearing from the chief, although it is not, he denies that he knows of this, of Robert Marbot, of the different things that are going on with that. He claims he's not heard of.
And Robert Marbot is the guy who says, take all these people indoors where there should be social services and feed them there because that's the only way they'll pay any attention, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that you're enabling people and blah, blah, blah. So that is interesting, that would be really, really.
Have you heard anything?
It's a fascinating thing that he claims not to know it, but he's and so maybe what's happened is the mythology of Robert Marbot's ideas are entering into popular culture law enforcement and anti-homeless community. Although I do know that. People from next door and these other places, that are working against the homeless, Janet Fardet and so on, have a massive amount of requests that the city hire Robert Marbot, and they argue his case, that enabling
background
services, all that.
You've been concerned about this for months, but I haven't seen any evidence that this is actually going forward. And I think it's, not that you shouldn't necessarily be prepared, but again, my question was whether you're taking any action to actually prepare for a physical response of people showing up with cameras and video and at least, or their friends.
Yeah, we're definitely going to have, we discussed that. We're definitely going to do our normal thing when we call a protest, the next, if we hit wind of that. We've also talked to, because part of the issue potentially could be, the idea of, talk of making a law, against feeding people or somehow, changing things so that people, have to get a permit or something like that. That's something that the chief indicated strongly in his meeting with Foodnotbombs.
But so far you haven't.
So that's where it's at.
You haven't had any reports of people actually being increasingly ticketed either in San Lorenzo Park or elsewhere.
Not like an increase. They're told that they have to leave.
Right.
Downtown.
So they're using a sort of the good cop rather than the bad cop approach.
And they're being, gently threatened.
Yeah, and then people
if they don't leave.
People are being encouraged to abandon their basic right to be in public spaces.
Correct.
Anything you want to add?
I'm going to have to go pretty soon, but this is the one thing that I find. And we're trying to investigate this, but the people that were kicked out originally from a post office, apparently the police that were doing it were brutal as far as laughing at them, disrespecting people, demeaning them. And so here's an issue with Mills too. He'd strongly said, told people down there and told us that, they would have to move by Monday. And then Friday, because of the large rat situation that they described it, his officers, not talking to him at all, decided they better move everyone away. So now we're trying to get the officers' cameras filmed from that. Because, see, we would have been there. We actually had already planned to sleep down there Saturday night and Sunday night to videotape it, but because they pulled, they gave everybody the impression it would be on, you know, Sunday night, Monday morning, we weren't there because they came and did it on Friday.
So they kind of stole a march on you there. And but of course, what you can now do is demand a rat size comparison between San Lorenzo Park and the post office.
Yeah, that, there's a issue. So then the I think that so we've had some discussions, but we think that the initial resistance to food and bombs is going to be introduction of some legislation that then we'll oppose, and then a passage of that legislation which we will defy, and so that's basically what's going to happen. And then we'll be like in the old days where we divide the food into thirds and people get arrested, and of course we already have a lot of people in the media interested in this subject, and it should become a massive media thing. We've actually I've written two letters to Mills, of one reminding him that that's the most likely thing that will happen is the city will become embarrassed, so, and I'm urging him to clarify what he meant when he said legislation. And it's funny because he does this thing where it's like the city is one group of people, and then he is something else, the police, or somehow not the city, but then when it's convenient, the city and the police are all the same people. So it's a fascinating...
We're going to have to leave it there.
His whole thing is very interesting.
We're going to have to leave it there, Keith. I think, again, I'm always wondering how much of this is apprehension and speculation, because I don't see a lot of evidence. I mean, you're drawing conclusions from a few statements, but who knows? I mean, it's certainly worthy to be cautious.
Yeah. I mean, he did say outright and that there would be this proposal for legislation.
I guess a question...
And he also did say that, he was... Almost everybody who's approached me believes that he was talking about food, not bombs, in the editorial.
Right. Well, of course, police like to threaten a lot, too. That's part of their modus operandi. What they're going to do may be something different. And, of course, the real question is, I'm wondering what's been happening up in Eureka since he left. But let me talk to you more again when I've got more time, and you do, too.
Okay. Well, take care. Hey, bye-bye.
Thanks, Keith.
Bye-bye.
We've been talking with Keith McHenry of Food, Not Bombs. You can talk to him, too, at 575-770-3377. Or go online to Santa Cruz Food, Not Bombs on the Facebook page. Got to reach Brent Adams, who's running the Warming Center. I'm not sure if they're open tonight, but maybe we'll find out. He spoke with me a few moments ago and said I could perhaps call him back and we could talk. You can hear the phone ringing in the background, but perhaps... this might not be the time for this to happen.
For the season, we'll reopen activation period in November due to forecasted temperatures. If you need emergency shelter, go to the Coral Street Homeless Services Center and get on all of their lists. If you need a blanket, leave a message and keep calling back. We are a blanket dispersal site and we'll get you one today. This is also the phone number for Brent Adams, Coalition on Homelessness, Subcommandante Films, the film production of Out of Sight, Out of Mind, and Santa Cruz Sanctuary Camp. Thank you very much, and let's take care of the people. Be well.
And that is, I guess, also, of course, an opportunity to leave a message. Looks like he got otherwise occupied. And now, in a... I was going to say a last desperate move, but it's not really a desperate move. It's a... kind of a planned move. I'm going to try to reach activist Steve Plaich, who also told us he would be available for discussions, questions, conundrums, and so forth.
Bob Norsch?
Sort of, yes. Steve Plaich?
Our intrepid reporter?
Well, I'm trying to do a report, and I should warn you, your words are going out over the air, will be, momentarily. So, are you ready to... Can you face...
I'm ready, sure.
You can face the public?
Yeah, I'm always facing the public. I am a man of the people, as you well know.
Well, I didn't get to the many of the Tuesday meetings, including the meeting with activists, bureaucrat Bob Aronson, who did later call me. He's the police auditor for Santa Cruz Police Department, all you listeners. And you, however, were there with a select group of, gosh, we wish the police were doing better. What are you going to do about it, to Bob Aronson? What is he going to do about it? Or what was your impression about that whole meeting?
Well, I think he just wanted to, he had reached out to me about a month and a half ago. I said, I'm in town a couple of times a month. I'd like to get together with you. I'd like to talk about issues around homelessness. I said, fine, be happy to do it. So he and I met over at the Ma. This is maybe going back 6 weeks. And had a good discussion for about an hour and a half, talking about, the landscape of homelessness, houselessness in Santa Cruz. And, compared to, against the backdrop of what he'd been doing in Santa Rosa, which is a completely different houseless demographic, of course, but, and, I was just trying to get him up to speed about, there are people who are staying at the post office, and there are people, that have been dispossessed from the city hall and the library, and people who, police chief is, at that time was just, musing about a new policy about enforcement of the camping ban. So after that meeting, he said, well, I really want to get together with a larger group of local activists doing work around houselessness. So I sent out a general email, which you were included in, and many others, with certain, exceptions. But, for the most part, it was most the people that we know doing work around the issue. And 12 folks showed up. So it was a good meeting, and I was great. I didn't really have much to say. It was an opportunity for, Keith and Abby, Stacy Falls, Harry Mazur from the Vets, Ron Pomerantz was there, people like that to kind of, take Bob's temperature about what he sees his role as not only police auditor, but as somebody who's concerned about houseless issues in Santa Cruz. And so we met for about an hour and 45 minutes, very generous with his time. And, I would say that the impressions of the group were positive. But, you'd have to ask each individual.
Well, what questions, Steve, did you note that were asked that struck you, and what answers were given that you found worth
mentioning? Abby, was concerned about, have you seen the videotape of the guy who was knocked down and mugged by the police downtown? That's Stacy Falls, whose husband, Steve, took the picture of the guy Hernandez, whatever his name was.
Hernandez was the cop who did it, yeah.
Yeah, so she wanted to know kind of whether he'd seen that. Abby and Keith wanted to know if he'd seen or received other complaints about police action with respect to houseless folks, and what his role is in that.
What did he answer to that, Steve?
Well, he said he saw those, that he investigated and made his report. I asked him whether or not, we talked about Sean Arp as well. Mm-hmm. I asked him, although his mandate is to kind of review procedurally police practices with respect to any particular incident, I asked him whether or not he made recommendations as well when he submitted his report to say that, the police need better training in de-escalation tactics, they need better, training in trauma-informed situations. And he said, that he does do some of that. I don't know whether he's going to do more of that when he's here. He did say the most notable thing he said. This was just him talking about his role and his what he viewed his role as. But the most notable thing was he said that to questions responding to Keith and Abby and people who do have reports about house assaults being treated poorly by the police, said anytime you get a report like that, send that to me directly.
Yeah.
So he wants to be a more direct conduit with activists who are actually observing the day-to-day.
That's not new information, Steve. That has always been the case.
Well, it was new information to the group.
Well,
it may have been. If you'd have been there, you could have said it was not new information.
It was not new information.
There, and so that's what
he
said.
I think the issue is what the results of these complaints have been. And it sounds like...
And had you been there, you could have asked him about what the results of these complaints were.
Well, I'm here, and I'm talking to you now. That's the point. The point I'm making is this isn't a criticism of you personally, Steve. It is a criticism of Aronson, and his whole approach, which is essentially a behind-the-curtain, behind-the-scenes, backdoor conferring with city council and police. But I'm not aware he's made public the results
You talked to him subsequent to this meeting. Didn't you ask him those questions yourself?
No. I got a message from him. He invited me to call him back. It has generally been his position in the past, but all this is confidential, see. Now, in olden times, by which I mean when there was a police review board that, you know, pretty much was worth very little until the end when they discontinued it because it started to be asking serious questions under Mark Halfmoon. But, you know, that board at least got the police department to make public, and they made public themselves, what the disposition of the complaints was. So, for instance,
Well, then they can do that within the confines of the Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, which is a statutory restriction in California as to what kind of information can be disclosed.
The question is whether Aronson has answered what Abby Samuels asked, which is, what was your response to the Hernandez's mistreatment of, I think it was Hardy? I'm not sure what his last name was.
Yeah, Hardy sounds right.
Yeah, something like that. And if he had no answer, and I'm not hearing from
him. I may have been called away because it was probably the same time that you called me, and I was talking to you whilst the meeting was.
Right, but at least at that point.
You should ask Abby.
Right.
Don't ask me.
Yeah, well, I'm asking you whatever you heard that you thought.
I didn't hear. All I heard was that he was aware of that. I don't even recall what he said in terms of how he responded or how he should have responded or what he would do different in the future if he received similar, incident reports.
So it sounds like the thing that impressed you was that he said, you know, talk to me directly as though this, because it was something
fairly
new to you.
I didn't say, and you misquote me as always, that I was not necessarily impressed by that. That's what he said.
What I'm saying is that
the group themselves,
I was asking you what you were impressed by, and I got the impression that that's what struck you.
Then your mistaken impression.
Well,
I was not necessarily.
Okay, well you could. Correct my impression. What did impress you, if anything?
He was willing to spend an hour and 45 minutes with people and to talk to them about issues that he thinks that they have, about which they have a shared concern. So, you know, more than that, I didn't necessarily think it was a particularly substantive meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing really came out to say, you know what, now we understand what the peace letter does, and now we know he's not an enemy, he's an ally, and now we know we can count him. None of that happened, you know. Mm-hmm. The first time, there's 12 people there, and I don't know that any of them, aside of myself, had even met him before.
It was not exactly
like you're getting a lot of detail about, you know, what he proposes to do or what he has done.
Any other ACLU people or members from, the group to fight racism, the community coalition to combat racism?
Well, Dennis Etler was there. Of course, I sit on that as well. So
you were both there.
Yeah. And I forget, Dennis asked him a couple of questions about some stuff, but it was everybody has their own, everybody has their own ox to gore. So, you know, it's, Harry was talking about something, and Lee Brokaw was talking about something different, Steve Baer, we've had three representatives of vets, they were talking about all these different things. Mostly, I would have to say that the predominant content of the meeting was Bob Aronson talking about, you know, that he'd like to get more involved in houseless issues in Santa Cruz and, you know, apologize for not being more engaged in the past.
Uh-huh. Well, then I think you said that when I spoke to you briefly, because you were in the midst of the meeting when we talked, that you were going off to, you were hoping to go off to the rent control gathering at City Hall.
Oh,
did you make it? And to give us a report on that, if you can.
Well, very vigorous. They had a lot of, this is more or less UCSC student fuel, which is refreshing to see, and some local activists. But they're over there, filled up the chamber. C.M. Berger, who and Zev herself, who you know are the leaders of the Santa Cruz Tenant Association, were there. And they were really kind of pushing council, and this was during oral communication, which made it all the more interesting, for, you know, rent freeze. They said, the rents are, you know, sky high in Santa Cruz, and they're driving people out of town, and we can't live here, and nobody can live here, and we need a rent freeze. So after this, it was maybe an hour of oral communication, Chris Krohn, as you may have read in the paper, made a motion for an emergency resolution that would have declared a rent freeze all across Santa Cruz until the matter is heard, which is going to be like in their, I think their December agenda or something like that. So he got so, but as what happens with Chris is that it's kind of a good intentions kind of, you know, overrun his knowledge of council procedure because he hasn't been there for a while. So they would have had to do several of the things. So it would have been conditions precedent to being able to even vote on that. So they couldn't even vote on it. But it was a neat thing for him to do. Mm-hmm. And people were very enthusiastically in support of that. Yes, you know, so Chris, you know, did a very courageous thing about just offering to the council. He never would have gotten the 5-2 vote he needed to even call the emergency resolution, but nevertheless, he did that.
Now, I understand.
So that lasted for quite a while.
Now, you're telling me that she extended, the Mayor Chase extended her communication to an hour. Was that done over any opposition from other council members that you noticed?
I don't think so, although there were people who were a little disappointed that when she said, now this is our last speaker, and then they did the same thing that they had done with, what was it, that kind of shame thing. Remember that council meeting they did?
Well, I know Ernestina got...
And then they said, if you won't do it, shut it down. Rent freeze or rent control now. If you don't do it, shut it down. So they were verging on trying to shut the council meeting down. Unfortunately, the council members had already, you know, gone back into the back, and then they had a couple of sergeant-at-arms come in, and there wasn't much resistance. Most of the people kind of vacated the premises voluntarily.
But there was a half an hour...
It was very raucous.
There was a half-hour extension of oral communication prior to that.
Well, I got over there. The oral communication, if it started at 5 o'clock, because I didn't get out of the meeting until about 5:45, so when I got over there, they still had maybe a half an hour or so to go. Oral communication, so they extended it quite a bit.
Now, what about the meeting that the rent control people were going to hold after the city council meeting? Did they actually do such a thing?
I have no idea, because I had other things to do, and they were kind of milling about outside the council chambers. They may very well have gone somewhere and had some kind of a meeting. They're very enthusiastic, very energetic around the issue, and as I say, it's great to see student engagement, and I think that C.M. Berger and Zav Ritzfeld have really done a great job of getting students involved in the issue of rent stabilization, rent control, rent freeze, like that. So,
how big was the crowd, would you estimate?
Well, the council chambers were packed, completely packed, and there are probably another 20, 30 people outside.
Oh, that's great.
It was a great showing.
Anything happen in the last week or two and upcoming in the next week or two that you want to comment on?
Well, tonight they're having a showing of a film at Cabrillo that has to do with social justice, and I think, and I'm drawing a blank on what it is. There's also a meeting up on the Hill. UCFC students are actually having kind of a rent-controlled theme, or actually an affordable housing theme / rent control theme meeting up there.
You know, when and where that is?
I don't. It's on. I think both those meetings are on Facebook. For sure, the Cabrillo thing's on Facebook. You didn't see it. It's called Standing Up Against the Light, or Standing Up Against the Darkness, or something like that. Bringing light into the darkness, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, yeah, so that's over Cabrillo.
So people listening to this broadcast, then, if they want, might want to go on Facebook, if they want to get up to, of course, UCSC at night is a parking nightmare, but...
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you.
Good luck with that. So anything coming up in a little more distantly that you know about a little bit more definitely, Steve?
Well, we're having our United Nations Association annual gala at the RCNV on Saturday afternoon from 1 to 4. We're going to be showing a movie that Al Jazeera produced called Silent Abuses by the Rohingya Refugees that are being driven out of Myanmar into Bangladesh, because that's one of our yearly goals for the UN. association, Adventist association, is refugee.
Now, is this a change? It sounds like an indoor venue. I mean, to see a movie for sure, but
we didn't have enough lead time nor enough money really to go ahead and get a city permit. Have Pacific and Cooper blocked off again as we did in past years. It just wasn't for us. We just didn't have enough energy around it, and I don't think we could have afforded it because our chapter is really kind of struggling financially. But we wanted to have some, so you know. We're going to have that, and I think there are, this is Affordable Housing Week, so there's a bunch of the stuff going on, but, more than you can anticipate. But I think the following Saturday is going to be this Muslim Solidarity event, which is also through RCNV, and because we just did a Voice from the Village show on the UN, UNA Day, and Refugees and Immigration this last Sunday. It was Jim Weller and a woman named Gigi Amir, who's with the Muslim Solidarity Group, Dennis Settler and myself, and your old friend, Sandino Gomez, is host. Mm-hmm. So that was very good. I can send you that link. If that link's available, actually, pretty much all over Facebook, but I can send it to you as YouTube. That's good stuff.
Well, why don't you do that, Steve? You know, is community TV on your show, at your showtime, which used to be on Sunday, as I remember?
Yeah, it was Sunday, the second and fourth Sundays of the month, an hour live from 7 to 8.
And is it available for the public to attend and
comment? Of course. Absolutely. We welcome people. We had several people in the audience this last Sunday because of the topic and the interest, but people can always come over and watch the show.
And where can people find the studio since it's moved since its earlier location?
325 Soquel Avenue, right next to the hindquarter.
Oh, my. So you can...
Where you order your prime rib 3 or 4 times a week, as I understand.
Actually, it's every night. I try to stay fit. You know.
Every night. With the baked potato, fully loaded baked potato.
And the appropriate dessert.
Who cares about cholesterol as we get older?
Yeah, well, you can't win them all.
So many different things going on.
The most important question, of course, is my old favorite and your organization, the Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project. What have you been up to lately in that regard, if anything? And then again,
I've been kind of...
Be honest now, Steve.
Some folks downtown, because of the uncertainty about this camping ban ticket issuance policy,
mm-hmm.
I've been kind of talking to folks and going over to the courthouse and kind of looking up there, you know, to see the progress of old tickets that they had and see what the situation is with new tickets. I just talked to a guy at the Monday Meal at the Red Church, which, as you know, we serve the bagels and do the whole thing. Because he had gotten a ticket, and then he got one of these correction notices where said, we meant to cite you for this, but we instead cited you for that, so you should know that we are correctly citing you for this other thing.
Mm-hmm.
But people want to know, I think, now, even with the heat off, anyway, you know, supposedly, for the camping van tickets, you know, the kind of the progress of their other many, many tickets they received before this change of policy. So, we did have the meeting for Phil and I's Safe Sleeping Spaces program. We had that over at City Hall 2 weeks ago on Tuesday. It was a nice gathering. We'll invite you to the next one if you'd like to come.
Sure.
People are sleeping down in San Lorenzo Park.
What have you found there? Have you heard of anybody getting tickets? If not in San Lorenzo Park, elsewhere?
No, as a matter of fact, I'll share with you next time I see you. Phil Posner did a really great questionnaire. It's titled Questionnaires Regarding Possible Homeless Shelter. And he's got several questions, and it was a pool of about 60 homeless folks. So it's a pretty decent pool size. For the people camping down Santa Rosa Park, we wanted to know, since they're being able to sleep down there right now, since they chased them away from the post office without being ticketed, what they would like to see in a safe sleeping space if one was created going forward. Because, as you know, as soon as the mainstream Santa Cruz gets wind of the fact that there are people, you know, sleeping undisturbed in Santa Rosa Park, the chief's going to get the same kind of nasty emails and letters that he got that, you know, that caused him to drive people into the post office. So it's an extremely temporary situation. So we're trying to get something maybe going that we can create a space for them so they can sleep when this policy changes.
What kind of help?
Due to public pressure.
Well, that's good. I mean, I'm glad you're following that. And if you, I had asked Keith McHenry earlier whether he'd received any reports of citations anywhere in town for sleeping or camping. He had not heard of any. Have you?
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the questions that was asked by Phil. Let's see here. You know, if I can see the plumbing. Because there was, as I was just kind of reading through his findings, whether or not people had been ticketed, and the indication was that they hadn't been ticketed in San Jose Park, but one of the responses was they were being ticketed elsewhere.
I see.
So I think what they're trying to do is, you know, this is the old kettling thing,
yep.
You know, about, you know, so they're trying to kettle people down there. And although you won't hear anybody say that, but I think that's probably what they're trying to do.
And if people want to get help from you, realistically speaking, Steve, I'm not asking you, this is not a PR move either way, but an honest assessment of what you feel you can do to help as a homeless legal person's assistant project person, what do you think are your limits? What can you offer, if anything? You know, you're...
Well, what would you say? What I can do is I can clarify their position with the court. So, you know, if they say, I don't know, there's people we know, and I won't mention any names because, you know, this is a matter of confidentiality, but there are people we know that have, you know, many, many, many tickets, and they're concerned about, well, do I have a warrant out? That's something I can just go to the courthouse form and look it up even on the computer over there. And see if they have any warrants, so they will be a little less, you know, anxious about their situation. That would, you know, that I can do. If they come to me and they say, you know, is it true that they're not ticketing people, you know, in Santa Rosa Park between the hours of 9 a.m. and 6 p.m., I say, you know, 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., I say, yeah, that's true. So, I mean, I can give that information to them, but mostly it's just helping people, you know, understand kind of what their position is in the local court system, because that's the thing that's most misunderstood, because homeless folks just don't respond to their tickets because they can't afford to pay them anyway, you know, and they just kind of continue to pile up, but at some point they get concerned about it when they feel like there's some heat being brought on the homeless community one way or another. They don't want to get scooped up for a warrant.
Right, I mean, actually, you know, actually, if you call the sheriff's department, and there's no danger, and you give the name, your name, they will tell you if you have a warrant or not. But people,
yeah,
maybe,
I'm aware of that, and I can do that home as well. But that, you know,
I mean, I advise people to do that directly, but I think it's good you're offering to do that as well.
Sure, yeah.
Heard anything about stay away orders? Because I know with the ACLU, you were working on that issue.
Yeah.
And I was chiding you.
Well, we're still open, you know, to get some response from Northern California about you know, taking on the stay away order, stay away ordinance. But I haven't heard anything about it. I haven't gathered any statistical data, you know, about that. So I don't know whether or not. Certainly, it's going to be applied selectively, and certainly it targets, you know, homeless people. There's no question about that.
Any response, you know, from the local ACLU?
Yeah.
Is the local ACLU likely to do anything? I've made numerous suggestions.
The local? No. But we did formally, you know, ask Northern California for legal assistance, and they were considering offering us some. So that's as far as that's got.
And when's your next meeting for those who are great supporters of the ACLU?
And we'd like to come and speak during our lengthy oral communication period where there are no restrictions on what you say and how long you say it.
Oh, are you kidding? I could go on for an hour.
We have a few minutes for you. You know that you're always
welcome. When is the next meeting?
Third Wednesday of the month at Bud Nelson, 7 o'clock.
So that would be coming up on the... we already had that, then.
Third Wednesday would be the 15th of next month, so that.
Yeah. Well, listen, Steve, again, your number for those who want to call you, do you mind if I give it out on the air?
Of course not. 466-6078.
466-6078.
6078. And I will certainly keep you in the loop. You're most welcome to join the next meeting we have about the Safe Sleeping Spaces program. We'd like to hear your views and have you involved. And Bob Branson wants to meet again, and so you'll be in that email list, so you can, if you're feeling better the next time, you can come and you can ask him the very questions that you've asked me that I haven't really been able to satisfactorily answer, but it's always best to be there and confront him yourself, as you know.
Yeah, and I will, of course, grill you about M.H. Cam next time we talk.
Of course, next time, yeah. Well, we'll save that for the next time.
Hey, thank you, Steve, for being in accessible.
Absolutely. Take care. Be well.
All right, man. Yeah, that was activist supervisorial candidate coming up in 2018, Steve Plaich. So if you're afraid to call the sheriff's department yourself, if you're apprehensive about calling the sheriff's, which you shouldn't be, or you don't have 50 cents, or you haven't got access to somebody else's phone, you can call Steve Plaich's number, which he just gave you, 466-6078. And maybe he'll get back to you. I say he's accessible, and that is true for today, but it was true yesterday or the day before, but it's often the case that he's not. He's a man who tends to go in many different places, and I find him hard to reach by phone, generally. Not in the last two phone calls, though, so thank you, Steve, for that. If you want to reach the sheriff's office directly and get warrants department, just give your name and say, like, no, if there are any warrants out for Mr. So-and-so, and you can ask, you don't even have to say it was you, 454-2370. Just sound confident and businesslike, and it should be no problem. 454-2370. The local ACLU, of course, continues to be a major disappointment, particularly since their funding comes through, I was told, 2,000 people in Santa Cruz County. The ACLU has had a huge expanse in membership since the Trump victory, and yet, of course, their actions around homeless civil rights are, at least in this city and county, very, very limited. They take great pride in saying, we've asked the Northern California ACLU to do something, but of course they could do all kinds of other things, at least as individuals. And indeed, some of them are. I mean, I've heard Peter Gelblum, whom I previously had nothing but scorn for, he's the president of the ACLU, actually beginning to defend, for example, the policies, insofar as they are currently being followed, of Andy Mills, the police chief around, at least not arresting or harassing not harassing people at San Lorenzo Park. I think I'm properly quoting Peter on this, or I could be wrong. I'm getting a more favorable impression of him anyway, at least in terms of his more recent statements. Let's see if we can reach Brent Adams now. And it looks like we're out of luck. Could be Brent was called away, or it could be he decided he didn't want to talk. Brent can be temperamental at different points, and he and I have very strongly different positions on protest and the value of protest in creating better policies with respect to civil rights for homeless people and even with respect to letting people, at least leaving them alone so they can shelter themselves, and maybe even providing a little optional shelter and facilities as well, which Brent has got done a lot of work around, and you heard his commercial for the warming center, or his announcement of the warming center. He's not charging you for it, so let's be honest about that. You can find him online if you want to look up his video activities, where he's documenting different abuses against the homeless, may still be in homeless people outside on Facebook. So now, perhaps a long-deserved and too-long-delayed musical break. This is another Randy Rainbow song parody called Just My Bill, about Bill O'Reilly. He's a top commentator at Fox News who was forced out in April after sexual harassment testimony came out. And, well, here's Randy Rainbow doing Bill.
I used to dream that I would discover the perfect lover for me. I knew I'd recognize him the moment he came on TV. I always used to fancy then he'd be one of those classy gentlemen. Like an Alex Jones, though he just pretends. Or the brain trusts over at Fox and Friends. Then along came Bill, an ordinary guy. A patriotic, fine, upstanding citizen.
He doesn't have a right to be in his country.
His angry rant.
Do it live.
His happy pants are not the kind that you would find on Chris Matthews. His career is dead. He's got a bigger head than Dr. Phil. I love him because he's wonderful.
Fucking thing sucks!
Because he's just my Bill.
How Black Lives Matter is killing Americans.
He may be moody, loud, and ungracious, a horny racist, old hack, and any woman he gives a job has to give him one back.
Entitlement!
Though sometimes he goes off the rails, he's as honorable as Roger Ailes. So I don't know why such hostility. If he's fine by him, that's enough for me.
So what does that mean, Bill? We've been listening all morning. We cannot.
I didn't hear a word she said. I was looking at the James Brown wig.
He's just my Bill, a really lovely guy, a calm, collected, virtuous philanthropist.
Come on, you coward!
His rugged looks, his children's books,
and things suck.
He's kind of a goofball, but boy, can he loof a. And I can't complain. He settled every claim with 13 mil. I love him because he's... No, not him. Because he's just mine.
Special bonus, I'm going to replay a song I particularly like from Randy Rainbow called Unpopular, a parody of Trump based upon the song Popular from the musical Wicked. But just a quick preview of what's coming up next Sunday. Going to be doing some on the scene and actually audible audio with the sheriff's deputies and the Lapis Road folks. We're also going to be doing Food Not Bombs interviews with folks on the street that we couldn't get to today, and a very articulate interview with Mike Zint of First They Came for the Homeless, the Poor Tour, as he calls it, or I should say a previous person with that group who is now found some housing but is still serving as a senior advisor. But now we're going to go directly into a discussion that actually is self-explanatory. That's a replay of Daniel Bernstein's Flashpoints from October 24th. So we're going to go musical, and then we're going to go directly into this Flashpoints panel discussion of a surprising, if perhaps only temporary, victory by the First They Came from the Homeless encampment. Berkeley Way.
Welcome back to this special edition of Face the Rainbow. Thank you for joining us as we celebrate a milestone with Donald Trump. Mr. Trump, you have been successfully claiming to be the president for 100 days now. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So how are you enjoying it?
I love doing it. I'm, you know, thoroughly enjoying it. It's something that I really love, and I think I've done a very good job at it.
In the time since you took office, no major legislation has been passed. You fired your national security advisor. Your health care plan collapsed. You're currently under investigation for possible ties to Russia. Melania is still living on Fifth Avenue. You continue to talk shit about Hillary Clinton, and your approval ratings are historically low. So, Donald...
Well, it's a...
Donald. Donald. Now that you've been in office for 100 days, I've decided to review your progress. Don't worry, I'm completely neutral. Whenever there's a president who no one really likes, and let's face it, you're a president who no one really likes, my snowflake heart tends to start to melt. And in only just 100 days, you've screwed up in so many ways.
Well,
I know. The setbacks you've been dealt, but in the case of you, though it's the worst case since, well, you know who, I'm sure as you don't pay your tax. Sit back, relax, 'cause here's the facts, you're just not, you know where I'm going with this. Popular, you're really unpopular. The country's fed up with you and what happened to all your pledges and your plans, like care that's affordable and a border wall and your schmucky travel bans. You're unpopular, like super unpopular. The swamp that you didn't drain despite your campaign, all the stuff you couldn't do, and how sad that even your wife won't move in with you. Don't think they'll carve your kisser next to Thomas's. Think of all your broken legislative promises. Time to acknowledge what a total bomb this is and say au revoir, go back to Mar-a-Lago, baby, 'cause you're unpopular.
Bish?
You're really unpopular. You've gone on to greater fame, but you've stayed the same. Corrupt and callous creep you were, well, are. And though you may not like it, you're kind of acting like Hitler. Lar.
Well, it's a...
Blah, 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 blah. You're kind of acting like Hitler. When I see such devastating record low approval ratings, I'm reminded of the stupid shit you've done. Like every single diss you gave, your demagogic misbehavior. You're so despised, I still don't know how you won. You're unpopular. Girl, you'll never be popular. Despite all your Twitter likes and your missile strikes and those bills you sign a lot. Very, very popular. You're not. You know, I think what we're dealing with here is an image issue. What would you say to a little presidential makeover?
I would not be happy.
Yes. Wait till Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un get a load of you. Oh, there you go. See? Pink goes good with orange. So with the USA now in disarray, here's what I pray you'll do. Give up, you psychopath, and go back to Fifth Avenue. I'm just kidding, shut up. Blah, 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 blah. She's unpopular, but not as unpopular. Congratulations.
Thank you.
K248BR in Santa Cruz and online at kpfa.org. The time is 5 p.m. Stay tuned next for Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, we feature a speak out and call in on homelessness. We'll speak to members of the And Then They Came for the Homeless at their encampment in Berkeley. We'll get a report back on today's legal ruling from attorney activist artist Ocean Newman. We'll speak to frontline activists for the homeless Susie Garner. We'll hear from Food Not Bombs founder Keith McHenry. We'll get a report back on the hell being paid by the homeless in Santa Cruz. Well, we have got a lot more for you. All this coming ahead straight up on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Forgive my call. This is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And today we're going to focus on homelessness. We're going to take it from the micro to the macro. We're going to start here in Berkeley, not far from where we broadcast on Pacifica Radio Station KPFA. And then we're going to take it out to Santa Cruz, and then we're going to take it nationally. Homelessness is indeed on the rise. The struggle is continuing, and if the 1% in power now have their way, we ain't seen nothing yet. There was a legal victory at an encampment. It's rare to have a victory if you are homeless in this world. This is a good day for that. And then they came for the homeless. They have an encampment in Berkeley. Let's start with the legal side. Ocean Newman, let's start with you in terms of the legality. What happened today? Just remind people, you know, basically what the camp is and what happened today.
So there's an encampment that's in Berkeley. It's located near the Oakland-Berkeley border. And one of the rare, extremely well organized camp. It's a camp that doesn't allow drugs and alcohol. And it's a camp that was started as a protest camp, as a demonstration about the fact that people in Berkeley don't have housing and the city is not doing anything about it. So it was intentionally, it was intended to be a visible demonstration of the fact that people are homeless and a cry out for some help for people who are homeless. And this encampment, unlike other encampments in Berkeley that were left alone, was repeatedly harassed and pushed from one place to another, to another, to another. People were cited, people's belongings were taken by the city of Berkeley over and over and over again. There was what they called it, the poor tour, because they would be at one place, they'd be kicked out of that, they'd go to the next place. Always with signs on their tents and flags and banners saying, the reason we're here is we don't have housing, we need help, and other similar statements. So they finally, after having been pushed, this place, they ended up in a little piece of land next to the BART tracks. The train goes by, you know, periodically, so you have to stop talking. But a little grassy knoll there next to, and they pitched their tents there. Between a sign, there's a piece of art, one word, big word spending here, big word spending there, and in between are these tents. And there they were allowed to stay since December last year. They were left alone, and everybody realized that this was a well-run camp, wasn't causing any problems, the community supported it, and there was a demand that came from the community to put in facilities, porta potty, so on, and that happened. So all of that was going on. Across the way, on the other side of the tracks, was another encampment of people who did not want to follow the rules that this encampment was imposing on people. And that encampment was next to, there were neighbors to that encampment. There were no neighbors really close to the one that I'm describing on the way. There were neighbors pretty close. And that encampment didn't have those rules, and there was activities there that were disturbing to the neighbors. And the neighbors got upset, and the neighbors were complaining. And then a couple of weeks ago, a woman died there of an overdose.
In that other camp.
In that other encampment. And that kind of tipped things over. And last Tuesday, the neighbors flooded into the city council in Berkeley, complaining about that encampment. Well, the next thing that happened was this Saturday, BART police came to both encampments, the one that was an intentional community and the one on the other side, and posted notices saying that they were trespassing and in 72 hours they would have to get out. People's suspicions are there was some collusion between the city of Berkeley and BART. The city of Berkeley has been denying it, but that's the sense.
Collusion, what would that mean?
Well, that the city of Berkeley basically said to BART, hey, there's a problem here. You know, we want you to deal with it, although we don't want to get our hands dirty. The city adamantly denies it, but that's what they said. So they came Saturday with a 72-hour notice. Basically, today, at 4 o'clock, everybody's going to be kicked out. And I went down to that camp Sunday, and people came around and said, hey, you're a lawyer, you got to go in and file a temporary restraining order. You know, it's our only hope. I said, look, you know, you're not going to get lawyers to do that in that kind of time. You know, big federal lawsuit, 1983 civil rights action in federal court. In one day? That's
right.
Just not it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I've seen dreams like
yeah,
that.
I'm sorry.
Before,
it's just not going to happen. Yeah. You better come up with some other idea. That one is crazy. I mean, that's not crazy, but I'm afraid it's not going to work. So then what happened? There's a person named Steve DiCaprio, homeless. And while he was homeless in a squatter, he decided that he'd had enough of being harassed by the police and, you know, not knowing the law and feeling that he must have some rights. And he decided to study law. He didn't go to law school, but he went in. There's a way you can do it. It's sort of you're working as an apprentice to a lawyer. David Bovay took him on. He worked there for David Bovay. And he passed the bar.
He became a homeless lawyer.
He had been busted for trespassing once when he was squatting. So the chapter right now, where we're at now, is that he's not been allowed to become a lawyer because of this terrible offense.
He passed the bar.
He passed the bar, but because he was busted for trespassing, they're not going to let him. He's not fit to be a lawyer. That's going to happen. I'm sure he's going to be a lawyer. Anyway, Steve, not caring about all of my concern, you know, that you can't do it, went in like a sort of a guerrilla lawyer and went down there and hand wrote out a civil rights complaint, informed God declarations, filed the damn thing in court, and got a hearing today on a temporary restraining order to prevent the BART from going in to this and evicting people as they were planning to do at 4 o'clock today. As we speak, basically, they would have been going down. So that hearing was held at 11 o'clock this morning in front of federal Judge Alsa. And at the hearing...
You were there?
I was there. Dan Siegel, a very well-known...
Local attorney?
Very well-known local attorney, civil rights attorney. He came in and said, look, I'm for this. I believe in this. I will represent you on this lawsuit. And took over this lawsuit, which these three people who were homeless in the encampments had filed on their own behalf. And went in front of a judge who is not a particularly sympathetic judge. I mean, how unsympathetic he is, he's really down on marijuana. I mean,
no liberal.
Dan Siegel.
Liberal.
No, Dan Siegel said, well, there's no drugs around. He said, marijuana? Is there marijuana? Are people coming from outside?
Hard liquor.
So
oxy.
Anyway, although he kept saying, you know, I don't see you have any law. I don't see you have any law. He kind of likes Dan Siegel. In the end, he said, "Look, I don't think you have any law on your side. I really don't. But I'm going to give you a week to come back." With a better written complaint, because this complaint, I mean, I was full of admiration they got it out. There were some things that could be improved if you had actually some time to file this thing.
Not many lawyers move that quickly.
No lawyers move that quickly that I know of.
Yeah.
I mean, really. So coming back on Halloween, he gave us till Thursday to file new papers, and the hearing is going to be on Tuesday. But between, we got a week, and we got a chance to get back in front of him and argue what the real issues are here that we want to argue, which is that people have to have a right to have a place to be. You can't just criminalize your way out of this crisis. You can't have one agency, one municipality just pushing people out of its jurisdiction into the next and into the next. You can't push this away. This isn't like leaf blowing, you know, where you have a leaf blower and the leaves still remain wherever they are. It's not okay to do that. There's got to be a problem here. If you're denying what people fundamentally need to live, habitation, a place where they can have some security in their possessions. And these are people, many of them, who are people with significant disabilities. I mean, you're not talking people
in this encampment.
Yeah, I mean, homeless people in general. I mean, if you look at the encampments all around, you'll find large numbers of people with disabilities, physical disabilities, mental disabilities, very, very vulnerable people who have had terrible experiences, and those are the people you're kicking out because, well, they're trespassing, and therefore we don't have any responsibility. The law doesn't require us to take care of them. The law doesn't require anybody to take care of them. But this case is about, well, actually, that can't be okay. You can't keep doing it. There's a fundamental rights here that are being violated, and it's got to stop somewhere.
What's the status now exactly? They were given a week.
They were given 1 week, which is, again, no time at all.
1 week. Do you hear that, everybody?
Come back with a rewritten complaint. That's the what starts the lawsuit. Alleging in words that are, you know, you could put together if you had more time what the issue is. And
the issue is?
The issue is that BART, by kicking people out, is violating fundamental rights, rights that are protected by the Constitution.
Which rights?
Well, we could enumerate them. There's the Fourth Amendment, which prevents the seizure of people, unreasonable searches and seizure of people's property. They are seizing with their mind. They're going to come in. They're going to take people's property. There's due process. They have to give them some kind of reasonable notice that allows them to do it. And there's a problem, Dennis, with our Constitution. The Constitution is not, I know this is a shock to you, It's not a protection of affirmative rights. It isn't a list of the right to housing, the right to health. It's limitations on what government can do. And so you have to work with what you've got. So one of the rights that we've been using is a right against cruel and unusual punishment. And what we're seeing is what's happening to people who are homeless. They are being cruelly and unusually punished by essentially criminalizing activities that they have no choice to do if they're going to stay alive and be human.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That is attorney, artist, activist Ocean Newman, author, I should say. And we're talking about, well, there was a breaking story around the camp that was founded, and then they came for the homeless. This is an encampment in Berkeley. We have some folks who, well, you're living at the encampment, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Introduce yourself. Tell us.
My name's Robin. I just moved to the Berkeley area recently to become an activist. I came from the Midwest, and I really felt opportunity out here. I actually decided to be homeless in St. Louis, and I had friends out here in an activist community that got me out here. And right whenever I got here, I saw so many houseless people on the streets that whenever something is just thrown in my face like that, and I'm a very social person, so I go and talk with all of them, I really feel like empowered to help them.
What was a day in the life at the camp like for you?
You know, every day it's different. You know, it's all on how you take it. You know, a lot of people can get stressed out. You know, I'm a person who's physically fit and, you know, able to do it pretty easily. I'm young mentally as well, so I'm able to take a lot of like the train. I can sleep through that, but a lot of people have sleeping problems and it's really hard for them.
You mean during the day, sleeping on the train? The noise of the train above, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the noise of the train right next to it, yeah. Transit. So yeah. That's going around every 15 minutes, and people are having migraines, and it's just all this stuff. And for me, it's like I have a huge community to support me as well, and I'm always doing activism, and I'm always keeping myself busy, but sometimes there's people that come, and they don't have, you know, much left, you know, and it's awesome that they can come here and, like, be able to talk to people and socialize and be able to actually have a community, because I've just seen so many people that whenever they are sleeping on the streets, you know, they push everybody away, and because a lot of people just steal from each other and it's using each other a lot.
So this inspires community, a real community attempt to really... Let me bring you into this, if I could. It's really Susie Varney. You helped me put the show together. Could you explain, say a little bit about yourself and your connection to this movement, and I guess you're pretty happy about today.
Definitely very happy about today. I've been involved with the camp since about December of last year, right before the last eviction where they were moved to the BART tracks, and I've been doing some artwork with them, mainly shadow puppet scenes, spreading the message of people who are living in the camp, so to make their voice a little bit louder and also to make a little bit more of a friendly view for people looking out from the inside, especially at night. So it's been wonderful to work with the camp. It's been one of the highlights of the time I've been living in Berkeley, which has been over the last 5 years, is to my visits to the camp, which originally were daily and now are weekly. I just can't say enough about how it feels like a really safe space. It feels really friendly. I feel really accepted there as a person in a way that I don't, even in a cafe or just on the sidewalk here in Berkeley. I feel like it's a really special and unique environment there, and it provides sanctuary for a lot of people. And
Tell us about some of the friendships you've made.
I've made friendships with people who I've been inspired by the activism. I've made friendships with... Adam Brendeberg has become a good friend of mine, been supportive to me in my own troubles, and also friends with Jay and other people who've passed on from the camp, who've moved away, some people who've had disabilities. I've been making art with these people. We did a shadow puppetry performance as a part of a fundraising last year, and I consider these people to be my good friends.
How do you, and this is a question for both of you, you can start, Susie, and then we'll go to you on this, but we were just speaking with Ocean Newman, and he was explaining that there were two separate camps, and apparently something went wrong at the other camp. It was being used as an excuse to get rid of this very organized activist camp that was founded with a vision. It sort of feels like, you know, somebody gets killed next door, so they come and say, well, you know what, you need to leave your house too because something terrible happened next door. Your thoughts on this?
Definitely, I feel that something like this has been coming. I have been surprised that the camp has been allowed to exist as long as it has in one location. But it's and it's a wonderful thing that has been the case. I definitely feel now that this was bound to happen, and I think it's nothing short of a miracle that we've got an opportunity to voice another side of this in front of a judge, and I'm really excited.
Robin?
You mean like regarding the camp on the other side?
The idea of the broad swipe, because something happens over there, they're going to come and get you. I mean, it's like, as I was saying, it's like living next door to somewhere where something happens terrible, and so they come to your house and say, you know, we got to take you too.
Yeah. Well, a lot of those people were actually people that we've actually had to, you know, ask to leave from the camp for doing hard drugs because, you know, we really want to be able to take anybody in. And so we don't hook anybody up to a lie detector and ask them if they're doing drugs. But what we do, it pretty much gets itself out within the next 3 days, and we can tell by people's actions and over time, and we have really strict rules on it and make sure that it doesn't happen. But sometimes it does because, you know, we want we're houseless, and we see other people that are houseless, and we want to take them in. You know, we feel sympathy for them, and sometimes they lie, and we find out that they lie, and then we get them out because we are protests, and that's what we're here to do, is not to have that stuff in there so we can protest. But at the same time, it's like I feel sympathy for these people because they are just out here, you know, victims of a system that they feel that they have to fill all these voids because they feel that they're not living up to the societal pressures of, you know, getting a job and being successful and obtaining all these materialistic items. And just because, you know, you don't have these items or you don't have this social status, then in society you're looked down upon. So the only way to, like, lift yourself up from that is to do these hard drugs, you know, and we want to empathize with the other camp, you know, and because they're a product of, you know, capitalism.
It's the same struggle that's going on.
It's the same struggle. Yeah. It's just sadly a lot of those people were on drugs and they had nowhere else to go and they found another plot of land right there. So,
all right, and we don't really know what's going on over there, so we're going to leave that side alone mm-hmm. for a bit. I want to let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're devoting the show today to homelessness. In a few minutes, we're going to be, you know, about 5:35 Pacific time, we're going to be taking phone calls at 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008 or 510-848-4425. And we want to get Keith McHenry. Do we have Keith now? Okay. Okay, we're going to take a musical break, and then we are going to come back and present a lot more for you, okay? And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Mike Zint is at the camp now. Mike, thanks for being patient. We had a little flip around here on the sheet, but we are so glad to have you. Where are you exactly? Are you at the camp now?
Yes, I'm sitting here on the side of the road listening to the live music.
And what are you listening to, by the way?
Holly Hammer is up, who is one of these local protest singers. She's been to a lot of the events that we've held.
So are you a bit excited? What's your response to this temporary victory the camp?
What this has done is it's demonstrated what we've been trying to say all along, that the homeless are just like every other person out there. The things that you see in the homeless community are identical to what you see in a house community. The only problem is it's more visible with the homeless. The drugs and alcohol exist in the house. And to see that a group of homeless who've been vilified by the press for God knows how long have stepped up and did what they did to protect this camp. They did this without guidance. They did this on their own. They took an action that needed to be taken to protect themselves and the stability that this camp has provided numerous people over the last 10 months. And I am impressed with what this camp has done. I've never thought in my wildest dreams that they would step up and perform such a miracle. And with the camp being as visible and as well known as it is, to have all of these tiny victories line up, I mean, this could be a changing event in the history of the United States. A sanctioned encampment is what's needed for total success, which the city is, of course, arguing about. But with 10 months of proven track record and some of the things this camp has accomplished, which really haven't been made public, it proves that what we're doing here is the right solution. And it's not to end homeless. They're not going to end homelessness by putting people in tents. But what you are going to do is allow them to take care of themselves and become self-sufficient to a point where the abuse of being homeless, the torture that the cities and the police do, they have an opportunity to get over that abuse, resting and having that stability and peace of mind. Most of these people have progressed into housing on their own just because of that stability. And this action that BART is about to or threatening to take, and the lack of sanctioning is risking the stability that's needed.
And BART, just to interrupt, BART seems to be acting in concert with
the Berkeley
leadership, the Berkeley mayor. Has the mayor come down there with sympathy? Has he been standing side by side? Have you locked arms with the mayor?
Well, I've uploaded the video of the police coming in and saying that the city pressured BART to do this.
Really?
The video's up. It's online.
So the mayor isn't there supporting you.
The mayor's not here. Cheryl Davila is supposed to come by. She might be here, but I'm kind of off to the side so I can hear what you're saying. But we do have a large group of people out here.
Okay. And tell us, what is at the heart of the matter? I mean, it's interesting. We talk about the city of Berkeley talks about violence and the dangers of the homeless, but we're sort of still reeling and thinking about things like what happened in Las Vegas. No, I don't think that was homeless.
No. What we're doing here is we're demanding the right to take care of ourselves. The situation in the country right now, if you're homeless, is you're not allowed to put up your own tent. You're not allowed to take care of yourself. You have to enter into a dysfunctional nanny state. And the services that are offered are not aid. They are solutions to remove the homeless from sight. If there was real aid or a real desire to help the homeless, we would not be getting raided. There would not be any threat of a raid. There would be full support from the city council, the mayor. We've already proven community support just by looking at the numbers of people that are out here, in responses I've seen both through the press and the internet. But it's just one step in the struggle that is not needed. Shelter being a right is just not the way to think about this. Shelter is a necessity. The first thing in a survival book says, build shelter. It's right there on page one in every book. Why can't the homeless do it? Well, my opinion is capitalism needs a threat to the slave class to keep them in line, to work those three jobs so they can't pay their bills. Homelessness is that threat. Abuse the homeless to keep the others in line. That's my opinion, but that's the opinion of a lot of the homeless that are in this group. And the fact that we're disabled and have already busted our butts trying to make it and failed because our bodies gave out just shows how predatory the current system is.
Mike, are you encouraging, is it your desire? Are you encouraging people to come down there and join you?
Yes. At this point, look, if they want to play, in all honesty, this is a numbers game, okay? And this is a game of wills and stubbornness. The reason that we're here and have been left alone for 10 months is because they said no 17 times and we said yes 18 times. That's it. Okay, and if we have to do a port tour 2.0, we're three times the size that we were last year. We've got much more community support. We now have a 10-month track record to go on saying, look, it works. Why are you in the way? Why are you preventing this? Why are you causing the suffering? That right there should sway opinion within city governments all over the country. We're being watched. Oakland just puts in a drug and alcohol-free solution. Richmond has been in contact for doing the same thing. There are cities up and down the coast that have already got them in place, and they've had great success. So why not Berkeley? If Berkeley does this, sanctions it, supports it, a lot of cities are going to do the same thing because they follow Berkeley. And I know the homeless deaths this year, they never get counted, the exposure deaths, but the estimates are between 40 and 45,000 American citizens are going to die this year from exposure because they're not allowed to live in a tent.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That is Mike Zent. He is talking to us from Berkeley, from the site of the encampment formed by, and then they came for the homeless. At first they came for the homeless, because then who's next and who's next and who's next and who's next? You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We've got that's the voice of Mike Zint. We've got Ocean Newman in the studio. We've got Susie Garner. We've got Robin here, and we also have Keith McHenry. Are you there, Keith? Yes, Keith.
Are you talking to me?
Okay. I don't think we have Keith. Okay. We have somebody else on the line. Keith, are you there?
Yeah, well, I'm Jonna, and I'm a friend of the camp, and I've been working with them since November. So I agree everything that Mike has said. I think the point is to have people meet the homeless, meet the houseless, because when you say the word homeless, you think they're an alien or something. They're dirty and all these things. Well, you know, they are people. I'm honored to meet this group, and I see how hard it is. What the First They Came for the Homeless does is they are a portal for people coming in. Many haven't been homeless before. Some have. And so the camp gives them stability. And I've watched them make some very tough decisions. And I'm so proud that they're here and that I can learn from them. And so I think that everybody should come on down. So I can answer any questions. I think that the city is complacent, because it's no reason why we should have a conversation that says, don't let people be in tents. I think the city is negligent. Let's treat people with dignity. When new people come in, let's say, hi, if you're trained or something, and anybody, how are you? What do you need? My name is, people are afraid to talk to
them. Let me ask you this. If the mayor had a...
So come on down and hear people's stories. I'll be there pretty soon.
Let me ask you this. Mike and whoever just joined us, if the mayor changed his mind and wanted to come down and join you and listen to the music and understand more about what's going on, would he be welcome?
Yes. My name's Jonna, and I'm part of the LeConte Neighborhood Association of Friends. Yes, we want the mayor to be there. They have invited the BART police to be there, because people have to know that houseless and people with houses, we're all part of a continuum. So when we protect human rights by saying that let's let them have a porta potty. I mean, this is disgraceful, all the meetings we've had to have, and it's the neglect of the city, which is praise on people not finding out who the homeless are.
Okay, thank you, Jenna. Hold on, Jenna. Okay, and hold on, Mike. I want to bring Ocean back into the conversation. I also want to bring Keith McHenry back in as well. But Ocean, you've been listening to all this. Some thoughts on what you've been hearing, because you've been writing like a madman here.
Well, I really agree with Mike Zint that this is important, and there's a crisis, and that the powers that be in all these jurisdictions just don't get it when they think that the solution is somehow to push people into shelters, which they're not going to go into, or some kind of portables or whatever. They don't understand that that people are supporting each other, that these are communities. They're not just individuals. And it's through the community that people are able to survive.
And it becomes a home opposed to a house, right?
But
wherever
thing,
it is.
One thing is also that I think it's really important what Robin said, which is that it's true that the encampment, First They Came for the Homeless, the Here There encampment, is drug and alcohol free. But we shouldn't get into a thing of demonizing all those other encampments that we see. Those people have a right to be there. They have a right to, they're human beings. Maybe they use drugs. They still are human beings. And they have a right to have a place of some kind of safety. And to deny them that right because they may have some used some substance, which God knows. If I was homeless, I'm pretty damn sure I'd be using some substance, given what it's like and given the amount of hopelessness that's there. And they are surviving, and they're taking care of each other. Sometimes they're ripping each other off, but they have communities. And we need to support them. We can't have a homeless policy that says, well, we're really into helping the homeless, but what it's really about is disappearing the homeless. We want to help them. We want to get them out of sight. We want them to get into a shelter. We want to get them into one of our portables and so on. We just don't want to look at them. And that's not going to work. So we're going to have encampment. We're going to have to definitely support the encampment of the clean and sober encampment. But we also have to support the right of people in all these other encampments that you see all over the city to have some basic ability to survive and not to be harassed and to live their lives.
Okay, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm going to give out the phone number, 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008. We're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to continue this discussion when we come back. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a special Flashpoints speak out and call in, and we're giving out the number 1-800-958-9008. Keith McHenry, founder of Food Not Bombs, you've been fighting this battle for a long time. Why don't you just come in the door of how bad is it in terms of the national level? How bad is the homelessness, hungry, if you will, situation? And how many kids are out there hungry?
Yeah, thanks, Dennis. Well, you know, the most recent study, which is actually in 2015, said there was 2,500,000 homeless children. And
2,500,000 homeless children.
People under 18 years old that are living on the streets. And now I came across that statistic when I was reading a series of articles about a manhole cover being lifted out of the street repeatedly in Seattle, and they couldn't understand why it was happening. Found out there was a colony of children living in the sewer, and apparently there are thousands and, you know, tens of thousands of Americans that live underground in our cities in sewers, which is really outrageous. But one of the things that, you know, that there's a national statistic which makes it sound like it's 500,000 homeless Americans, a new report that came out. And I've been feeding people for 37 years now on the streets. And I have to say, in all that time, often people will come to me and tell me, like once or twice a month, I just became homeless, I just started living on the streets, do you know where there's other food programs or things like that? In October, in the first 6 days, six different individuals came to me asking, telling me that they just had lost their place and they were living outside and they wanted to know where it was safe to sleep or where to access services. And it's, and this is month after month now where as many as six people share with me that it's their first days living outside. And I did not have that for the first like three decades of doing this. So I think, you know, the statistics are misleading. I think it's huge. And every Food Not Bombs itself in each of the cities will send photos on Facebook and stuff of ever larger lines of people coming to eat with desperate pleas for more volunteers and more support. And I know Associated Press actually is doing a a series on the dramatic increase in homelessness in the West, in California, where there's like Los Angeles was saying, it was nearly 30% increase in 12 months of number of people living on the streets of
30%
LA.
Increase in 1 year.
In 1 year in Los Angeles. And this is, I think, it's nearly double the number of people living on the streets of Santa Cruz from 2 years ago, from what the point in time count. So the issue is the number of individuals moving onto the streets, you know, against their will is dramatic. And I think I'm really concerned that there's going to be an even greater number of people suffering. First of all, you know, and we think of this, that in the months and years before a person lives on the street, and I think most of our listeners can relate to this, you are freaking out trying to keep your housing situation together. It's painful to experience those first days, particularly shocking. You see this post-traumatic stress situation when you walk out of that last place that you had as a secure place and safe place to sleep out into the streets. That is shocking that so many millions of Americans have had to go through that experience in the richest country in the world. It's just it's astounding, the level of pain. And that people, I just was attending a meeting of the police auditor here in Santa Cruz, because the police have made it their number one issue is handling the homeless crisis. And they've the new chief of police, who made a name for himself, Andy Mills, in dealing with homeless crisis in Eureka, California, has become the new chief of police here. And it's brutal.
And Keith, is it true that at one point the local visionaries in the city council and local politicians actually paid for a sort of anti-mosquito machine to run the homeless out from under an overpass to drown them out with noise?
Actually, this city has done a huge number of anti-homeless things in just the last 5 years, and one of them is to spend thousands of dollars on mosquito boxes, which were placed under all the bridges along the San Lorenzo River where people would go to get out of the rain. They also have placed them in
to drive them out by noise. Definitely.
You can't be in the area at all. You become nauseous and it's just so harsh that you have to flee. So have to go into the rain. If that doesn't work, in areas where they haven't put the mosquito boxes, the police systematically go around to all the overhangs and chase people out. And then the post office here, which is where Punapam shares food every Saturday and Sunday at 4 o'clock, in a campaign to drive us out of the area to try to stop the meal, they placed a fence around the post office, and part of it was to keep people from sleeping under the overhang in front of our beautiful historic building. And it's just one of the many things. They hired a whole nother round of rangers who have now been told that the Pacific Mall is a park, and they go systematically up and down the street telling people they can't sit on the ground and giving them tickets for that. And then most recently, Andy Mills, the new chief of police, went and announced a campaign which he implemented, which is to drive all the people that live, sleep around downtown Santa Cruz and around the post office on Front Street and Water Street and Pacific Avenue and so on, out of the area. And did a sweep, driving everybody out, I think it would be last Friday, and ordering them basically to sleep on the river in this one area. But we know from experience that that's going to be a short-lived event. And it seems to be that it's giving, the idea is to give the impression that he's tough on homelessness and had the success. But the people living around where he's driven everybody to were are very soon to start agitating and demanding that they be removed from that area.
Keith, how many times, let me interrupt, I'm sorry, how many times have you arrested for giving out food to very hungry people?
I was arrested, approximately 100 times. I had 47 felony conspiracy to serve free food in violation of a court order cases in San Francisco, and quite a number of misdemeanor cases. And then I was also arrested in Florida for feeding people there. And the district attorney in San Francisco said I had done 500 days in jail when I settled a three-strike case where I was framed under the California three-strike law.
And so, a lot of times when you get arrested giving out food to very hungry people, the cops who are arresting you throw the food in the garbage, right?
Correct.
And let the people go hungry.
They sometimes even just throw it on the ground in front
of them. Just throw it on the ground. Step on it, maybe.
And they torment the people, sadly. And it is heartbreaking to see a person who, you know, people would be surprised in the United States, but there is a lot of times people have come up to eat at Kudnap Bombs and said they hadn't eaten in 2 days and 3 days. Now, often it's a relatively new person to the streets who doesn't know the where the soup kitchens are and so on. But it's people depend on these meals. And you'll see people crying. There was actually the first time Kudnap Bombs was arrested on August 15th of 88 at Golden Gate Park. There's a audio recording of the event where you can hear people so angry at the food being taken that they suggested to go across the street to what's now Whole Foods, but at the time Cal Foods, and just start taking the food off the shelves. They were so angry.
All right, let me interrupt here. That's the voice of Keith McHenry, of founder of Food Not Bombs. We're going to get in some phone calls as well. Everybody stand by. Let's go first to, I think, Joe. Are you there?
Hello, are you talking to me?
Is this Joe? You have a question?
Oh, yeah. Okay, my name is Don Joe. But anyway, I'm glad I'm on the air. My name is Greg. But anyway, I've been listening to thank you, Mr. Bernstein. I've been listening to the program, and, my heart goes out. I've been homeless before. And you know what? This is a reflection of society, You know, there's a saying that a society is measured by, you know, how they deal with the most vulnerable. So this tells you all about this country, and that they're trying to penalize people that, you know, just ran into different circumstances causes this. And you never know, what triggered, situations like this. And they don't care. They emphasize profit over people. And also, the fact that, we should be learning from these other countries, European countries, that have, low rates of homelessness. What's Switzerland, Sweden doing? And why do they have low rates of homelessness? Places like that in Canada, our neighbors to the north.
Okay, Greg, I'm gonna thank you for those comments. And we're going to go to Joe, is that right? In LA. Joe, join us.
This is Joe.
Go for it.
Oh, great. So I also, like Keith, am part of Food Not Bombs and feed the homeless at the camps here in Oakland. They're, of course, people that are plagued by all sorts of problems and do use substances, but they're courageous, they're brave. And I've been seeing that, as I would imagine, from the example of first they came for the homeless, the camps are getting much more self-contained and self-sufficient and cleaner, and it's really great to see. You know, I think people need to realize that white people in this country, the privileged people in this country, have grown up with a mindset that they've done something that gives them the right to this privilege, that there is some sort of merit to being on the right side of, the culture and playing the game.
All right.
Trump administration makes it so clear that it is just, a criminal kind of immorality that started these people on their road to prosperity. And we're all at some level of that sort of
cultural sequentialist. And that's why it's such a privilege to hear the people on this show.
Thank you. Thank you for
risen above that kind of, you know, misguided thinking and can see and feel with their hearts.
Thank you for sharing that. We appreciate that. And you're listening to Flashpoints. Now I think we're going to Andrew in L.A. Are you there, Andrew?
Yeah, greetings, folks.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for the show. We got to take care of all members of our society appropriately, I think. Two questions. First, if I may, did anyone mention if there is any government group or other group of all the stakeholders who sit down and discuss this and try and find solutions? And then secondly, if I may, do the homeless camps govern themselves? Do they have any sort of council that the stakeholders within the camps themselves can participate in governing themselves? Thank you very much.
Who wants to start? Who wants to talk to that? You want to talk to that?
Yeah, this is Robin, who's currently living at the camp. I can answer your second question. I can't answer your first question right now, but within the governance, we basically all ask each other. You know, it's pretty anarchical. You know, we just all get each other's opinions. It's really small, organized. We have meetings every Wednesday, and we just all vote, and we all
decide. Is it consensus? It's essentially consensus.
Yeah, basically consensus to what's best for the protest style of the camp. You know, there's sometimes we have to do things that go against our morals a bit, specifically because it's a protest instead of just a help center. But it's also a help center, but it's mainly a protest for the wider view of homelessness in the entire United States and the entire world, you know, to show that these people, you know, really matter and that they need someone to speak up for them.
Did you want to jump in, Osha?
Yeah, I mean, I think the camp that Robin's part of is unusually well organized and intentional, but all the encampments that I've been in, I've been in a lot of them around Berkeley, there's a informal kind of way that they make decisions and look out for each other. It's not like they sit down and have votes, but they know each other, they have a sense of what's important for the community and so on. They are really a community that takes care of itself. In terms of the question of is there some larger governmental organization that in some consistent way is bringing together the feds and the state and the county and the locale? No, that doesn't exist.
I wonder what that agency would look like.
Well, you know, if it had actual input.
An agency for those, to help those without homes, those without houses to find a way to live in some kind of home, some kind of collective way, under a tent or wherever.
Well, it would be kind of extraordinary, and what particularly would be extraordinary if it actually listened to the voices of the people out in the street. I mean, one of the problems is that policy is a lot made by people who have never been homeless and don't talk to the people who are homeless. They don't know what's going on. And so they make policy for them without any real understanding of who they are or what their needs are, how they organize, or, as Mike Sin said, how people take care of themselves. Because really, this government is not going to take care of people. People are going to need to be able to take care of themselves. We don't want government to get, at least government should not get in the way and make their lives more difficult, which is what's happening. What's happening with the here-there encampment, what's happening all over. And so far as people are trying to make a life under the... The government is making it more difficult rather than actually helping.
Okay, I think, did you say Dan? Dan, you want to join us?
Hello.
Is this Dan Siegel?
My name is Dan.
Dan, just go right ahead.
I had a question for Food Not Bomb. I was wondering if, you know, how prohibitive it would be to, like, buy a permit and then sell burritos for a nickel or something as a way around the prohibition on giving food away. Like, what if you could sell it for a dollar or something that was really cheap, or even 50 cents? Have you ever thought about that, or is there any possibility, and what are the barriers to
Keith,
something like that?
Keith, you want to deal with that? Keith McHenry?
This is Keith, with co-founder of Food Not Bombs. The reality is that you don't... we have tried that, and the police didn't care, and in fact, it caused more problems. The issue is that it's actually, particularly in San Francisco, where it's very brutal, the violence against us, there was no actual law against what we're doing. And what we came to understand is that under the environmental health codes, even in throughout the country, because there is no economic advantage to us to give away unsafe food, there is no need to get an environmental health permit. It's a gift of compassion from one person to another. So we're not governed by the government, and we made the mistake in 1988 of applying for permits from the government, and the government did everything it could to make sure we did not receive any permits, and then we had to sue them in federal court and have a judge order them to issue a permit, which as soon as that federal judge retired was taken away from us under the pretense that our sign wasn't our health certificate was not properly adhered to a tent that we were serving out of, and a unhoused person had taken a slice of cake before we were ready to serve. So we have learned our lesson in all these cities that and have come to the understanding that you do not need a permit to share food. And the reason for permit processes is to take away those permits. And we are having that struggle down here in Santa Cruz, where we met with the chief of police this past week because he put out an op-ed piece that was seemed to be very clearly stating that they were going to try to do something to shut this meal down in Santa Cruz.